My name is Dale Lambert, and I have the privilege of chairing this session this morning. Regrettably, in talking to David Poulton late last night, he had a family emergency arise and is unable to attend this morning. And so he asked if I would read his paper for him, and then we will rely on Dr. Appleby to give us insight. One thing for certain, it will be as fresh to me as it is to you, and I hope I don't stumble too badly over some of the philosophical terms. But he was very apologetic, and it's one of those things that happen. I will read the paper for David Poulton. I don't know Professor Poulton other than I know he received his PhD from the University of Michigan, is that correct? And I know that he's a lot smarter than I am. And the reason I know that is because he used to be a lawyer and became a philosopher. And I'm still a lawyer. Dr. Peter Appleby, who will respond to this paper, is even smarter because he served as a mentor to David Palmer and was his first philosophy professor and instrumental in changing him from being a lawyer to being a philosopher. Dr. Appleby is chairman of the University of Utah Philosophy Department, specializing in teaching ethics and religion, and is the author of a number of journal articles and has recently finished a book that will be published sometime in the future, The Claims of Faith, Religion, and Humanistic Perspective. And we're very pleased to have him here to help us with this presentation. I've read briefly the paper this morning, and I think you'll find it very interesting, and I hope you'll forgive me when I trip over a few terms that I'm not particularly familiar with. The first part is background, and it was perhaps a little heavier than the second part, although it's necessary background to understand the second part, which I found both interesting and quite moving. The paper is entitled, as you know, The God of Abraham, Isaac, and William James. The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob has often been distinguished from the God of the philosophers. The latter is allegedly only a human conception, a product of rational theologizing. While the philosopher's God is variously conceived, it is usually said to be infinite, wholly simple, immaterial, incorporeal, non-spatial, non-temporal, absolutely immutable, and impassible. By way of contrast, the biblical record describes the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as the living God, who created men in his own image and likeness, who spoke with Moses face to face as a man speaketh unto his friend, and who disclosed himself in and through Jesus of Nazareth. He is the loving God who is profoundly touched by the feelings of our infirmities, and involved in our individual and collective lives. Not all philosophers have accepted the philosopher's God. Some reject this God on strictly logical grounds. For instance, Anthony Kenney argues that the God which is the product of rational theologizing is irrational, an incoherent concept, a logically impossible being. Others, like Nicholas Walterstorff, taking Christian revelation as basic, reject the philosopher's God on scriptural grounds. One of the most articulate dissenters from the God of the classical theistic tradition is the American pragmatist William James. He rejected the God of the philosophers not because he thought it logically incoherent, nor because he found it incompatible with Christian revelation. Instead, he adds to the indictment of Kenney and Walterstorff a third charge: the God of the philosophers is pragmatically meaningless. In this paper, I first try to formulate precisely James' criteria of pragmatic meaning. Next, I attempt to clarify the structure of his arguments against the God of the philosophers, and in the process, I show that James' argument tend to vindicate pragmatically the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. First, James' theory of pragmatic meaning. Though James' ideas on pragmatic meaning are central to his philosophy, they are largely embedded in his individual analysis of the meanings of particular philosophical claims and concepts. To get clear about James' meaning criteria, then, will require both logical extraction and constructive interpretation. In doing so, I draw heavily on the understanding of James' theory set forth by Ellen Cappy Sukiel in her recent book, The Pragmatic Philosophy of William James. She succeeds admirably, I believe, in her stated intention to account for James' numerous remarks on meaning in a way that show them to embody a single principle consistent within itself of a piece of the remainder of his philosophy. Her analysis is careful, informed, and I believe essentially correct. James' pragmatic philosophy, Sukiel contends, is grounded on his conception of the human being as a goal-positing, interest-fulfilling organism. Better be careful with that word. Whose rational activities are subservient to his practical and emotional aspects. James states his position unequivocally, quote, "The mind is an essentially theological mechanism. I mean by this that the conceiving or theorizing faculty functions exclusively for the sake of ends that are set by our emotional and practical subjectivity altogether. It is a transformer of the world of our impressions into a totally different world, the world of our conception, and the transformation is effected in the interests of our volitional nature and for no other purpose whatsoever. Thus, James sees our cognitive activities, concept formation, belief acquisition, theory construction, as instruments molded by our desires and interests whose natural endpoint is action and conduct. Their role is to redirect us into experience, better prepared to overcome future obstacles to what we will. On these assumptions, our beliefs, theories, and concepts are meaningful to the extent that they contribute to the achievement of our concrete or practical ends." To arrive at a more exact formulation of James' criterion of pragmatic meaning, Sukiel carefully considered Lovejoy's analysis of James' view given in his essay, The 13 Pragmatisms. For our purposes, I believe a brief review of Sukiel's summary and critique of Lovejoy's analysis will sufficiently illuminate the issue. Lovejoy argues that while James intends to provide a single criterion for pragmatic meaning, he actually ends up with two. James may be understood, Lovejoy claims, as holding that the meaning of a proposition is restricted to its predictive import. The future experiential consequences, which those who accept the proposition ipso facto anticipate as experiences that somebody is subsequently to have. Yet elsewhere, James apparently takes the pragmatic meaning of a proposition to consist entirely in the future consequences of believing it, independently of whether the proposition itself seems to entail experiential consequences. On this criteria, anything a person believed would be pragmatically meaningful so long as believing it had practical consequences in his life. Lovejoy claims that these two criteria are not only equivalent, they are incompatible. For example, on the first criterion, the idealistic claim that the absolute exists would be meaningless since no particular empirical consequences follow from the assumption that is true, while on the second criteria, the same proposition would be meaningful so long as belief in the absolute had some practical effect on the life of the believer. If such a belief were, for instance, emotionally restorative or morally consoling. Finally, Lovejoy argues that each criterion is in its own way inadequate. The first criterion is far too narrow, eliminating metaphysical, theological, and moral propositions from the realm of pragmatically significant discourse. But the second criterion, Lovejoy alleges, is far too broad, in that it would hold as meaningful any belief with practical impact, even if the belief were too vague or incoherent to be considered intelligible in any ordinary sense of the term. For example, the belief that the evil is a form of good might somehow function in an energizing or inspiring way for its believers, and would thus be considered meaningful on James' second criteria, in spite of the fact that it made no literal sense whatsoever. Sakiel asserts that Lovejoy's bifurcation of James' theory is incorrect. First, she finds that James' notion of predictive import is richer than Lovejoy supposes, involving much more than a proposition's narrowly empirical consequences. In fact, on James's view, she argues the predictive import of a proposition may be eschatological, is that correct? Or even metaphysical in character. Thus, for instance, the proposition God exists can be meaningful on James' predictive import criterion, for this proposition enables the theist to anticipate a different cosmic future, even if not a different empirical one, from that anticipated by a non-theist. On the hypothesis that God is there to ensure it, we may expect the preservation and ultimate fulfillment of moral ideals, while on the materialistic hypothesis, we may not. Thus, on James' predictive import criterion, then, a proposition is pragmatically meaningful only if those who accept it ipso facto anticipate either empirical or metaphysical consequences. Hence, Lovejoy's criticisms that James' criterion is too narrow is incorrect. As evidence that James holds that a proposition lacking predictive import is still meaningful as long as believing it has practical consequences, Lovejoy cites James' discussion of absolute idealism and pragmatism. There, James asserts that even though you cannot redescend into the world of particulars by the absolute's aid or deduce any necessary consequences of detail important for your life from your idea of his nature, belief in the absolute still has pragmatic meaning in that it provides security and religious comfort for some people. Contrary to Lovejoy's view of this passage, Sakiel tries to show on a closer and wider examination of the relevant text that James did not intend pragmatic meaning to consist of consequences of belief in isolation from anything else. Even the proof text Lovejoy cites does not support his interpretation. What James actually asserts is that, quote, you cannot deduce any necessary consequences of detail important to your life from your idea of the absolute's nature. One cannot make any specific predictions from the claim that the absolute exists, nor can one make detailed inferences from future cosmic events. Yet if the absolute exists, then we may anticipate that good will prevail. And it is due to this very expectations that believers in the absolute derive religious comfort and feel entitled to drop the worry of their finite responsibilities. So rather than separating the consequences of believing a proposition from its predictive import and thereby leaving the former unexplained, Sakiel sees the two as functioning inseparably as part of a single principle in James's theory. A meaningful proposition leads the believer into the future prepared than he would be if he did not hold it. It enables him to make predictions about the future and thus leads him to have certain attitudes and emotions, and most importantly, engages him in certain sorts of conduct that are, relative to his purposes, appropriate to that future as envisioned. Thus, Sakiel concludes that the pragmatic meaning of a proposition is determined by the consequences that follow from it, conjoined with the different attitudes, feelings, and actions in the life of the believer which arise from the very fact that he anticipates those consequences. On Soukile's analysis, it seems that James' criteria of pragmatic meaning, hereinafter CPM, so when I say CPM, criterion of pragmatic meaning, can be precisely formulated as follows. First, a proposition has pragmatic meaning if and only if it has predictive import in the broad sense. Two, if a proposition has predictive import in the broad sense, then believing it will lead to practical consequences. So, three, a proposition has pragmatic meaning only if believing it has practical consequences. From one, it follows that, and this is that predictive import provides a positive test for pragmatic meaning, and the lack of predictive import provides a negative test. And from two and three, it follows that five, The absence of practical consequences provides a negative test of pragmatic meaning, but the existence of practical consequences fails to provide a positive test. And further, six, pragmatic meaning admits of gradations or degrees. The greater, the more concrete, the more definite the predictive import, the practical consequences of belief, the greater its degree of pragmatic meaning. Finally, this analysis of pragmatic meaning grounds James' related notion of pragmatic value or truth. It suggests that a pragmatically meaningful is true to the extent that its predictive consequences are in fact verified and its practical consequences are beneficial to the believer. Second, the CPM and the nature of God. Armed with the more precise formulations of James' CPM, we should now be able to understand more clearly his pragmatic arguments for and against particular views of God's nature. We shall look at seven such argument or argument clusters. First, the metaphysical attributes. James rejected much of traditional theism, especially as it was elaborated in scholastic philosophy, suggesting that both its a priori methodology and many of its tenets were diseases of the philosophy shops that obscured and falsifies God's nature and his relationship with men. Concerning this method, James argues that whatever conceptual clarification may be achieved through carefully working out the analytical content of the word God, this activity has no relevance to any human concern. Quote, what is their deduction of metaphysical attributes but a shuffling and matching of pedantic dictionary adjectives, aloof from morals, aloof from human needs, something that might be worked out from the mere word God by one of those logical machines of wood and brass which resent is contrived as well as by a man of flesh and blood. I misread that. But they have the trail of the serpent over them. One feels that in the theologian's hands, they are only a set of titles obtained by a mechanical manipulation of synonyms. Verbality has stepped into this place of vision, professionalism into that of life. Instead of bread, we have a stone. Instead of a fish, a serpent. Did such a conglomeration of abstract terms give really the gist of our knowledge of the deity? Schools of theology might indeed continue to flourish, but religion, vital religion, would have taken its flight from the world. End quote. Regarding the particular metaphysical attributes thus derived, James argues, take God's aseity, for example, or his necessariness, his immortality, his simplicity or superiority to this kind of inner variety in succession, which would find the finite beings, his indivisibility and lack of the inner distinctions of being and activity, substance and accidents, potentiality and actuality, and the rest, his reputation of inclusion in a genus, his actualized infinity, his self-sufficiency, self-love, and absolute felicity in himself. Candidly speaking, how do such qualities as these any definite connection with our life? And if they severally called for no distinctive adaptations of our conduct, What vital difference can it possibly make to man's religion, whether they are true or false? To quote James, "For my own part, I must frankly confess that even though these attributes were faultlessly deduced, I cannot conceive of its being of the smallest consequence to us religiously, that any of them should be true. Pray, what specific act can I perform in order to adapt myself the better to God's simplicity? Or how does it assist me to plan my behavior, to know that his happiness is anyhow absolutely complete? So much for the metaphysical attributes of God. From the point of view of practical religion, the metaphysical monster which they offer to our worship is an absolute worthless invention of the scholarly mind." End of quote. Much could be said by way of criticism of these arguments. James seems uncharacteristically intolerant. His judgments are hasty and unduly summary, and to a large extent he unjustly tried to set and block. Yet in light of our analysis of his CPM, the intended structure of his argument seems clear. These metaphysical attributes each fails the negative tests of CPM. Believing in them fails to call for any responsive adaptions in our concrete feelings, attitudes, or conduct. The basic form of each of James' arguments against the metaphysical attributes can be represented as follows. 1. The proposition is pragmatically meaningful only if believing it has practical consequences for one's feelings, attitudes, and conduct. 2. Believing that God is X, absolutely simple, etc., fails to call any responsive adaptions in our feelings, attitudes, or conducts. 3. Hence, the belief that God is X, absolutely simple, etc., is pragmatically meaningless. In defense of James' rather weak-appearing justification of the second premise of each argument, it is important to recognize that it is difficult, if not impossible, to positively establish broad negative assertions of this type. Reasonably, then, the burden of persuasion here must shift to the person who claims that any of the attributes in question has pragmatic import. With the basic structure of James's arguments against the so-called metaphysical arguments now delineated, examination of each claim made can now be more fruitfully pursued. And the second argument he makes then is divine personality. On the basis of his CPM, James concludes the belief that God is non-personal is meaningless, while belief that God is personal is pragmatically vindicated. Considering the former point, James's charge that Bradley's absolute is also a metaphysical monster in that it lacks the attributes characteristic of personhood. Quote, "It is neither intelligence nor will, neither a self nor a collection of selves, neither truthful, good, or beautiful. It neither acts nor suffers, loves or hates. It has no needs, desires, or aspirations, no failures or successes, friends or enemies, victories or defeats." End quote. So understood, the belief that Bradley's absolute exists seemingly calls for no vital human responses, and thus, by the negative tests of CPM, is devoid of pragmatic meaning. Similarly, James asserts that the unknowable of Spencer would not serve as a substitute for the personal God of theism. Quote, "Mere existence commands no reverence whatsoever, or any emotion until its quality is specified. Neither does any cosmic power, unless it makes for something which can claim kinship from our sympathies. As well might you speak of being irreverent to space or disrespectful to the equator." End quote. Thanks. Although James rejected substantial elements of scholastic theism, he nonetheless believed that theism offers the best chance of an adequate understanding of God. This is because it alone conceives of God in terms of personality and personal relationships. Pragmatically, it is essential, James said, that God first be conceived as the deepest power in the universe, and second, that he, quote, be conceived under the form of a mental personality. The personality need not be determined intrinsically even further than involved in the holding of certain things dear and in the recognition of our dispositions toward those things, themselves being all good and righteous things. Extrinsically considered, so to speak, God's personality is to be regarded like any other personality as something lying outside of my own and other than me, in whose existence I simply come upon and find. A power not ourselves, then, which not only makes for righteousness, but means it, and which recognizes us, in whatever respects the divine personality may differ from ours or may resemble it. The two, at least in this, that the two that both have purposes for which they care, and each can hear the other's call. End of quote. The challenges of man's moral and spiritual life require help and guidance, which only a divine person and co-worker can provide. Understanding God to be a personal thou who is pursuing purposes of his own and who caringly responds to our calls for help with our own is rich in both predictive import and practical consequences. We expect to receive such help and guidance, and the expectation gives hope, overcomes fears, and influences conduct. Third, omniscience, omnipotence, and moral goodness. These attributes, James argues, stand on a much stronger footing pragmatically than do the so-called metaphysical attributes, for they too positively determine fear and hope and expectation and are the foundation for the saintly life. Quote, being holy, God will nothing but the good. Being omnipotent, he can secure its triumph. Being omniscient, he can see us in the dark. Being just, he can punish us for what he sees. Being loving, he can pardon too. Being morally unalterable, we can count on him securely. These beliefs, the positive test of CPM, in that they clearly have predictive import and thus call for significant adaptations in our feelings, attitudes, and conduct. Fourth, divine eminence. While cosmic predictive import are on James's CPM sufficiently to salvage meaning for many religious belief, it is also vitally important that God be actively involved in our individual lives and in our collective histories. He must make a difference not only for our eternal life, but for our day-to-day existence. James pictures God and men as collaborators in the vast task of building a moral universe. And in this creative and redemptive task, James says God must not be above dirtying his own hands. The prince of darkness may be a gentleman, as we are told he is, but whatever the God of earth and heaven is, he can surely be no gentleman. His mental services are needed in the sweat and dirt of our human trials, even more than his dignity is needed. End of quote. A God so understood seems preeminently to satisfy the positive test of James's CPM. Fifth, timeless eternity versus temporal eternity. The timelessly eternal God would be absolutely immutable and impassible. As such, it would not be touched with the feelings of our infirmities, nor responsively involved in the sweat and dirt of our human trials. Neither could it be involved with us in the vast task of building a moral universe, for it would have neither history nor future. A belief in such an absolutely static divinity seemingly lacks both predictive and practical import, and hence by the negative tests of CPM and is pragmatically meaningless. James states, quote, all the categories of my sympathy are knit up with things that have a history. I have neither eyes nor ears nor heart nor mind for anything of an opposite description, and the stagnant felicity of the absolute's own perfection moves me as little as I move it. End quote. On the other hand, James finds the view that God is temporally eternal rich in pragmatic significance. Quote, having an environment, being in time, and working out a history just like ourselves, he escapes from the foreignness, from all that is human, of the static, timeless, perfect absolute. If God be working out a history just like ourselves, we must enjoy an intimacy with him and respond to his will in a way that is impossible under any other system. Our whole active nature is quickened by the thought that we are co-laborers with God, aiding in the realization of purposes that are ours as well as quote. Six, divine finitude. Perhaps the most controversial implication of the CPM is the warrant James thinks it provides for the belief that God is to some extent finite. Instead, he claims that the only God worthy of his name must be finite. In what respect? Perhaps most fundamental in the respect that God does not comprise the whole of reality, and hence has an external environment, presumably not entirely of his own making. Quote, God, in the religious life of ordinary men, is the name not of the whole of things, heaven forbid, but only of the ideal tendency in things, believed in as a superhuman person who calls us to cooperate in his purposes, and who furthers ours if they are worthy. He works in an external environment, has limits, and has enemies, end quote. Among other things, this absolutistic understanding of God enables James to come to grips with the so-called problem of evil. If God were the whole of reality, he would be an accessory before or during the fact, and ultimately responsible for all the suffering and evil that pervades our human experience. On those premises, James finds it difficult to see how God could possibly be understood as all-loving or perfectly good. But if God truly works in an external environment, has limits and enemies, then the problem of evil becomes primarily a practical task calling for cooperative action to constrain or reduce it, not a theoretical puzzle. Further, James holds that belief in a finite God is pragmatically richer than belief in an absolutely unlimited God, that it provides a greater motivation to our moral endeavors. Any world other than the pluralistic one with a finite God, James says, takes away all of life's real achievements as well as its losses. The finite God is pluralistic universe is, on that account, more approachable and more of a real leader and inspirer. In a passage in Pragmatism, James imagines God, before the creation, putting forth to us the following proposal. Quote, I am going to make a world not certain to be saved, a world the perfection of which shall be conditional merely. The condition being that each several agent does its own level best. I offer you the chance of taking part in such a world. Its safety, you see, is unwarranted. It is a real adventure with real danger, yet it may win through. It is a social scheme of cooperative work genuinely to be done. Will you join the procession? Will you trust yourself and trust the other agents enough to face the risk? End quote. James believes that there is a healthy-minded buoyancy in most of us, most of the time, that would impel us to accept the risk. Similarly, in the dilemma of determinism, he posits an open and indeterminate universe with us finite human agents having freedom significant enough for us to make a difference here and now in the world's outcomes. Believing this, James says, is what gives the palpitating reality of our moral life and makes it tingle with so strange and elaborate an excitement. Seventh, God as a preserver of value. Whatever pragmatic value attaches to a world of genuine adventure and risk, James also recognizes our profound human need for religious comfort and security. Indeed, in the dilemma of determinism, he is anxious to show by means of his noted chess game analogy how belief is a non-determined human freedom is compatible with belief in divine providence. That is, with the expectation that God can and will fulfill all of his purposes and promises. This is reinforced in a moving passage in Varieties where James writes, "The luster of the present hour is always borrowed from the background of possibility that goes with. Let our common experiences be enveloped in eternal moral order. Let our suffering have an immortal significance. Let heaven smile upon the earth and deities pay their visits. Let faith and hope be the atmosphere which man breathes in, and his days pass by with zest. They stir with prospects. They thrill with remoter values. Place round them, on the contrary, the curdling cold and gloom and absence of all permanent meaning, which for pure naturalism and the popular science evolutionism of our time are all that is visible ultimately, and the thrill stops short or turns rather to anxious trembling. For naturalism, fed on recent cosmological speculation, mankind is in a position similar to that of a set of people living on a frozen lake, surrounded by cliffs over which there is no escape, yet knowing that little by little the ice is melting and the inevitable day drawing near that the last film of it will disappear, and to be drowned will be the human creature's portion. The merrier the skating, the warmer the more sparkling the sun by day, the ruddier the bonfires by night, the more poignant the sadness with which one must take in the meaning of the total situation," end quote. The belief that God exists and is the preserver of value, when translated into its pragmatic meaning, transforms the sadness into vibrant hope and living. It means that where God is, quote, tragedy is only provisional and partial, and shipwreck and dissolution are not the absolutely final things, end quote. Conclusions. We have reached a point at which to summarize and draw some tentative conclusions. First, these are among the principal attributes that, on James' own analysis, fail to satisfy his criteria of pragmatic meaning. Infinite in all respects, identical with whole and reality, absolute simplicity, immateriality, non-inclusion in the genus, total self-sufficiency, and so forth. All of these attributes, I would hazard, are products of rational theologizing and thus characteristic of what we have called the God of philosophers. On the other hand, the following seem partially descriptive of a being who passes James' pragmatic test, a personal thou with whom we may have dealings, who is morally perfect, who has purposes and plans and is working out his history and time, and who is creatively engaged with us in building a moral universe, who has knowledge and power to fulfill all his purposes and promises, who cares profoundly for our welfare, even so as to be involved with us in the dirt and sweat of our daily human trials, because of whom our shipwrecks need not be absolutely final things. This description, so far as it goes, I believe, fits fairly with the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. James, of course, was not unaware of this. He makes it clear that in rejecting the God of philosophers, he was not thereby rejecting the God of the Bible. I conclude with his own declaration. Quote, "I must parenthetically ask you to distinguish the notion of the absolute carefully from that of another object with which it is liable to become heedlessly entangled. that other object is the God of common people and their religion. The God of our popular Christianity is but one member of a pluralistic system. He and we stand outside of each other, just as the devil. The saints and the angels stand outside of both of us. I can hardly conceive of anything more different from the absolute than the God, say, of David or of Isaiah. That God is an essentially finite being in the cosmos, not with the cosmos in him. If it should prove probable that the absolute does not exist, it will not follow in the slightest degree that a God like that of David, Isaiah, or Jesus may not exist, or may not be the most important existence in the universe for us to acknowledge. Dr. Appleton.
Well, I know how to say eschatological. I've said it several times. Dale, you've done a very graceful job of taking over this session, beginning at 10 o'clock last night or so. And I am now in a rather difficult position, I feel, first criticizing my former student and a philosopher whom I admire a great deal when he's not here. And secondly, in this uplifting atmosphere, knocking the Leo Baskalia of philosophy, who has just been ably portrayed to us as a Mormon. But I'm going to do it. First, a word in defense of the God of philosophers. There is no such thing. This is, in James's work and elsewhere, a polemical notion at best, and typically a straw man. For starters, Bradley's absolute. Bradley's absolute is the product of a great deal of metaphysical speculation and argument, and it was the furthest thing in Bradley's mind from an attempt at articulating an object of every man's worship. If Bradley thought that somebody was worshiping his absolute, I'm quite sure he would have thought that was an immensely comic enterprise. Secondly, the God of orthodoxy, which is much attacked in this discourse, is indeed partially a product of rational, philosophical, and theological understanding. But that is, but not merely a product of unconstrained philosophical reflection. The philosophers to whom James implicitly refers here are philosophers who are also theologians, who are also deeply committed churchmen. And I'll just give you an inventory of a few of them: the patristic apologists, St. Augustine, St. Thomas Aquinas, St. Anselm, St. Bonaventure, and John Calvin were certainly all very able philosophical thinkers, but very far from people who sat around and invented gods in their studies without concern for their religious import. Secondly, James's theological views. It may be a kind of ad hominem attack, but I think it's worth mentioning that James was, in his thought about what philosophy should be and what the business of philosophy is all about, heavily influenced by a lifelong struggle with depression. We didn't have imipramine and Prozac in those days, and James fought out a terrible struggle with depression and found solace in philosophical theorizing of a certain sort, namely the sort that you have just had explained. And part and parcel of this was a deep impatience with logical rigor. In spite of the fact that James was himself trained as a physician and was a first-rate scientist, he was very impatient with logic, and his correspondence with the great Charles Peirce shows over again, Peirce writing to his friend saying, "James, why don't you take a course in logic?" And James writes back and says, "Because it's too damn much trouble." Third, there is in James, as in many of his contemporaries in the great intellectual world of Harvard at his time, an absolutely visceral and unreflective anti-Catholicism, which he imbibed, no doubt, with his mother's milk. But over and over through his writings, you will see wisecracks about Catholicism, Catholic thought, and anything to do with, as he says somewhere or other, popes and masses. This does not put him in a favorable position for analyzing the works of scholastic theology. And he doesn't, in effect, take intellectually difficult issues seriously. But now, with that in mind, let's provisionally accept David's account of the criterion of pragmatic meaningfulness. And let's turn it onto one attribute discussed in David's paper, that of divine simplicity, which James mocks a good deal, as you have heard, and thinks it is a mere artifact of idle theological speculation. But the notion of divine simplicity that comes down to us from the great medieval theologians and philosophers is a notion which is intimately connected with the idea that God is incorruptible. To say that something is incorruptible means, in its moral sense, of course, that it is not capable of, that it is not subject to moral corruption, moral deterioration. But more centrally, in its metaphysical aspect, it means incapable of disintegration. That is to say, it cannot be disintegrated, it cannot be taken down into pieces. What is corruptible is something which can be disassembled. That is to say, what is corruptible can be disassembled is something which is made of parts. And God, in his simplicity, the theologians say, is not made of parts. Now, I think I may be getting into familiar territory here. The doctrine that the divine nature is simple was adopted, no doubt, for logical reasons. It has to do with a great deal with the logic of predicates applied to the divine nature. It helps with such doctrines as the Christian notion that God is always present, that he is omnipresent, that he has no particular spatial location. And it is negatively related to the spiritual nature of God, who, according to orthodoxy, has neither body, parts, nor passions. Now, I think that if James thought about it, in light of the history of Joseph Smith and his successors, he would see that divine simplicity was a key element in the conflict between orthodoxy and Mormon anthropomorphism, and that it is hardly a matter of pragmatic insignificance to say that God, that the divine nature is simple in this sense. I mention this just to show how these very abstract notions of theology do, in fact, have a pragmatic impact on the life of faith. It is not that the people in the pews on Sunday meditate at length on the notion of divine simplicity, but the fact of the matter is that it is centrally connected to this notion of corporeality, corruptibility, capable of being taken apart, and the orthodox doctrine that God has neither body, parts, nor passions, which is, of course, denied in the Mormon literature, which says that God has body, parts, and passions. Now, as to the constraints of logic, again, this is, in the kind of discourse that James provides us, a much disrespected virtue. Some of us remember the saying that a vulgar consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds, but we usually leave out the word vulgar and say consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds. But I will refer you to page 10 of David's exposition of James, in which he says that, he, James, says that being omnipotent, God can secure the triumph of good over evil. And on page 13, in the imagined discourse from the time before the world is created, James says, God makes a world not certain to be saved. Now, I want to suggest that you can't have it both ways. Either God is omnipotent and can secure the triumph of good over evil, or God makes a world which is not certain to be saved, but it's not easy to see how he can do both. Finally, on the religious adequacy of finitism, Mill, James, and David Paulson, to the extent that he endorses these views, think that the finitist conception of God provides a solution to what David calls the so-called problem of evil. But if one works this out carefully, I think one will find that in order to eliminate the problem of evil, what one has to do is to divest God of any effective power whatsoever. I won't argue that point here. I have argued it entirely successfully in a paper presented to the Sunstone Symposium some years ago, and you can buy a copy of it out there at the bookseller if you want. But finally, one word. There was a great debate, and a very interesting one, between William James and a philosopher named Clifford on what comes in the literature to be called the ethics of belief. James argues, again dispositionally, that it's very important to seek truth. Clifford argues that the higher duty is to avoid effort, and Clifford burst into the literature with a famous ringing slogan, "It is wrong always and everywhere for anyone to believe anything upon insufficient evidence." James argues in turn that it is better to seek truth and not worry so much about making mistakes. But the question here, I don't propose to solve that problem. James, in the essay on the will to believe, says that our religious mistakes, after all, aren't all that important. But once again, notice that this is the remark of a sanguine Harvard intellectual of the end of the 19th century who has no great concern about the history of religious conflict, the history of evils done in the name of religion. Is it true that errors in religion are not matters of great moment? If so, the pragmatic theory of meaningfulness might be just the ticket. But if you don't take that sanguine view about mistakes in religion, if not, we might ask what sort of wisdom there is in relying on a philosophy of dispositions, of feeling, of positive attitude, without much concern for truth. Thank you. By my clock, we have 3 minutes.
If you have any questions, please direct them to Dr. Appleton or comments. And I apologize if I didn't give you more time.
Well, it's a long paper. It's a long paper.
Any comments?
Sir.
I don't know if you can answer this in 2 minutes, but do you see any distinction between the criteria of pragmatic meaning and the criteria of truth?
Well, again, that was a bone of contention between Peirce and James, which led Peirce eventually to call his own view pragmaticism, saying that it was so ugly that nobody would use that term and confuse it with James's views. James, in fact, does not make any such distinction. Now, in fairness, it has to be said that James devoted most of his philosophical work to sort of popular lectures, but he really does collapse that distinction as far as I can see, so that the pragmatic theory of meaningfulness comes out to be a pragmatic theory of truth. And that's where I would attack it, you see, because I think it's one question to ask what belief is sort of life-enhancing. And that's a very different question from what belief is true, the way I look at things. Yes, please. Well, I think it's plausible to argue that if it doesn't work, it isn't true. But it's not so plausible, I think, to argue that if it does work, it is true. Thinking as fast as I can, I'll give you an idiotic sort of example. It worked for a long time for people to believe. It worked entirely satisfactorily for people to believe that the Earth is roughly flat. But it's not true. And it wouldn't be true. It wasn't true even when it was widely believed. So one can make that sort of distinction. And even in the social sciences, I should think, one has to ask questions of in what ways is it working well? That is, psychologically, we could we could say, take a Freudian theory of human personality, works beautifully, and we can employ that theory without any danger of refutation of it, as long as we don't push too hard, say, on the notion of cures for psychological disorders. Yeah, right. I mean, we don't ask that nasty question. If somebody were cured by Freudian psychotherapy, how would anybody know? We'll just keep on doing it. Sir?
I was wondering if you think it would be a dangerous
thing. Well, that's, indeed, that's just the point of James's, I think, most famous essay, The Will to Believe. In effect, in which he confronts the religion versus, say, agnostic or atheist option as one which has to do with the quality of your life. And if he says you come to an abyss where you've either got to jump or perish for staying on one side, where you try to imagine that the evidence for the religious option and the non-religious option are sort of equal as far as you can discern it, then you are intellectually justified, let's say, perhaps morally and even logically justified in making that leap of faith, on the grounds that doing it that way is going to save your life. And you see, that's where the business about depression comes in. If it's an even money bet and you have to go one way or another, you're going to get a certain confirmation out of moving in the direction of the religious option that was just expounded here, and there's no loss. There's no possible loss. And there will be, you see, then we get back to the pragmatic theory of truth. There will be a sort of confirmation of that, right? Because you're going to live a happy and fulfilled life, and you're not going to commit suicide because you're so depressed. And in the way that this gentleman is talking about, you get a kind of confirmation of the truth of the religious option because you've done that, you see. And that's where, in response to the lady in the back, I have to go back one step and say, yeah, but there's a different notion of truth, too. And it does finally matter whether there is such a God as the one you leapt to. Sure.
I would say
the
backside
culture
belongs in your argument. We're not, or practically we're not. Anything but practice.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah. Maybe I don't fully grasp your point.
Is it practical to analyze whether truth is practical enough?
Yes, it is, yeah.
So you're working with yourself, and you're saying the truth is not, and the search for truth is not practical.
Oh, I'm very far from denying the pragmatic value of, say, the pursuit of truth.
Not only pragmatic, but recursive.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm afraid we've got to quit.
Thank you very much. If any of you like to talk, Dr. Ray.
Thank you. Well, you picked up the ball late in the game.
Yeah,
do you have a durable or special power?